This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In order to investigate his stories, journalist Jerry Mitchell has had to rely on some very unsavory sources, white supremacists. Talking with them has led him to documents and information that has helped bring to justice four Ku Klux Klan members, including Byron De La Beckwith, who was convicted for the 1963 assassination of Medgar Evers, and Edgar Ray Killen, who was found guilty last June of arranging the murders of civil rights workers Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Michael Schwerner. Mitchell tracked down Billy Roy Pitts, who had been involved in the 1966 death of civil rights leader Vernon Dahmer, but had never served a day for his crime. And Mitchell found the hole in the alibi of Bobby Frank Cherry, who was a suspect in the 1963 bombing of a Birmingham church that killed four girls. Mitchell writes for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi, and he has reported on his own paper's earlier complicity with the Klan. In recognition of his work, next Tuesday, Mitchell will receive the John Chancellor Award for Excellence in Journalism, administered by the Columbia School of Journalism. Mitchell got access to thousands of documents from a secretive group called the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. I asked him how he did it.
Basically, somebody leaked them to me. That's the simple answer. But the Sovereignty Commission was basically an estate segregationist spy agency. It had one arm that was basically kind of a propaganda arm, in which they would send white and even black speakers, who happened to be paid, by the way, up north to say, oh, we love segregation. We love the Southern way of life. And it was kind of a defense for Jim Crow. And then they had another arm, a much more nefarious spy arm, where they would infiltrate civil rights groups and report back and harass people, get people fired from their jobs. There were all sorts of terrible things that the commission did. And it was kind of formed in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education in 1956 and existed until the early 70s. And then the files were sealed by the Mississippi legislature in 1977 for 50 years. But then a lawsuit was filed challenging that, and that's what was ongoing in 1989 when I began to get those first files. I'm kind of like a kid. If someone tells me I can't have something, I want it like 1,000 times worse. So I began to develop sources who began to leak the documents to me.
So this commission, was it actually officially attached to the state?
Not only was it a state agency, it was run by the governor himself.
So the governor, was this Governor mm-hmm. Ross Barnett?
Well, in 1956, it would have been Governor J.P. Coleman, and then after him, of course, Governor Ross Barnett, and then Governor Paul Johnson.
So these governors actually ran this secret mm-hmm. commission that spied on civil rights groups.
Right. Correct.
So how did you end up being the mm-hmm. person to whom the documents from the secret commission were leaked?
People like me.
Mr. Popularity.
No, I'm kidding. I don't know. I think I'm kind of the, I always term myself kind of the opposite of Mike Wallace, you know. I guess people, I don't know, Klansmen talk to me, all sorts of things. It's kind of bizarre. I'm just not a person who comes very aggressively at people. I just kind of let them have their say, including these Klansmen. And so a lot of them have talked to me. And like I mentioned with sources, I've just been very fortunate to have sources that have leaked these documents to me over the years.
I mean, do you ever mislead your sources into thinking that you're racist
no.
too and that you're behind
oh, no.
their thinking?
No.
Uh-huh.
No, not at all. Although, interestingly, as a reporter, you do a certain amount that is chameleon-like, in a sense, that you don't necessarily state your own opinion. And so, therefore, people you talk to may presume you think the same way, these Klansmen, because you're white, because you're Southern, you know, because you've had this upbringing. But I never misled them. I never told them I believed what they were saying or anything along those lines.
So what were some of the more amazing things that you learned, some of the more amazing facts that were in the files of the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission?
Oh. Well, for example, and this was a story that ran in September of 1989, I found out that Mickey Schwerner, who was one of the three civil rights workers who was killed in 1964. Both he and his wife, Rita, were spied on by the state 3 months before he and the other two civil rights workers were killed. And I found that extremely fascinating, particularly given that the state was cooperating at that point with the Meridian Police Department and in Meridian, Mississippi. And basically that police department was infiltrated by the Ku Klux Klan. And in fact, the guy that was the main shooter of the three civil rights workers, his brother was on the Meridian Police Department. So it's really not too much of a stretch to believe that the kind of spying and things that the Sovereignty Commission was doing may have well made it into the hands of the Klan.
Did this information have anything to do with reopening the case?
Actually, that story didn't. There were some brief look at that case in early 1989 after the movie came out, but then the state didn't bother. And what did lead to the most recent reopening of the case was in 1998. I did a story. There was the guy that was the head of the Klan in Mississippi was a guy by the name of Sam Bowers. He was the Imperial Wizard. And of course, the Klan in Mississippi was the White Knights, and they were the most violent Klan organization in the United States, responsible for at least 10 murders that we know of. And of course, Bowers ordered those as Imperial Wizard, including the three civil rights workers. Well, he did this kind of legacy interview with state archives officials. And it was supposed to be sealed, still is, sealed until he dies. But I managed to get one of my sources yet again to share that with me. And in that interview, Bowers said that he was happy to be convicted in the 1967 federal conspiracy trial that they did have for 18 men in the three civil rights workers case on federal conspiracy charges. He was happy to be convicted and have the main instigator of the entire affair walk out of the courtroom a free man. And that man, the man he was referring to, was Edgar Ray Killen, who was basically a recruiter, organizer for the Klan.
So after you published that, people realized they should find Edgar Ray Killen.
The family's call for the case to be reopened, and so the state did reopen the case.
And he was convicted.
Yes, he was.
Not very long ago.
In June.
Let me ask you about another case that you were involved with. Billy Roy Pitts had been convicted in the murder of civil rights leader Vernon Dahmer. He was convicted, but apparently he never did any time. You looked into this. What did you find?
I found that he never served a day of his life sentence.
He had a life sentence, and did people assume he was serving time?
Well, it was kind of confusing because the way it had been explained to me was that he had gone into a federal witness protection program, what I'd been told. And so when I began to look, I was just trying to do a story about the time that these people did, how much time in prison these various guys did. I was told as I was talking to someone with the Federal Bureau of Prisons, I said something about, well, yeah, I've heard that he went to the federal witness protection program and when he got out of prison. And they said, well, it didn't exist then. I was like, oh. So I had already heard from the state that they didn't have any record of him doing the time. So I just thought it was maybe some deal worked out with the witness protection program. But once I found out there wasn't a witness protection program in existence at that time, then I knew the answer. He hadn't done a day of his life sentence. So, this sounds like one of those advertisements for an internet company, but I went on to switchboard.com and typed in, because I didn't know where he was, and typed in his name, and up it popped. And, there was his name, address, phone number, and so I called him, and the first 20 minutes of the conversation were like, how'd you find me? How'd you find me? I'm like, it's on the internet. So he basically, they issued a warrant for his arrest. So he went on the lam for about 3 weeks, and I got this cassette tape from him in the mail, and I played the tape, and it said, Jerry, I just thought I'd let you know you've ruined my life. But I promise if I talk to anybody, I talk to you, so here's this tape. So he proceeds to talk about his involvement in killing Vernon Dahmer, his involvement in some other Klan violence, and basically turned himself in a few days later.
Now, why would he want to do that, do you think? You know, why would he want to send you this cassette confession?
I don't know. I don't know. It's amazing to me. I think what it is with him and many of these others that I have talked to is everyone wants to tell their story. And I'm sure you've found that too. Everyone loves to tell their story, and I found it true to be true of Klansmen too.
Well, let's face it, a lot of people I interview, they want to tell their story because they've just written a new book or something.
Well, there you go.
They haven't usually just committed a crime or committed a crime
well,
30
true.
Years ago that they're still trying to cover up. So, do you often wonder about the motivation of people who talk to you and leak you documents who were and still are racist?
It's amazing. And like Bobby Cherry in the Birmingham church bombing case, one of the last living suspects, his wife emailed me, wanted me to come interview him down in Texas. And I said, okay. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm the last person that I would be calling if I were one of these old cluckers that was suspected in a crime. And so I went down, you know, took him and his wife out for barbecue because, well, I guess that's what you take Klansmen out for. I'm not really sure. But anyway, so I spent about 6 hours talking to him, and he insisted on his innocence. He was like, why? I didn't have anything to do with that church bombing. I left that sign shop, and the sign shop's like 2.5 blocks from where the church blew up. I left that sign shop at 9:45 because I had to get home and watch wrestling, and which even to us as Southerners is pretty funny. But anyway, so I got back to the newspaper and had our librarian, Susan Gray, contact Birmingham News and said, you know, just check, see what's on TV that night. I didn't think anything about it. Next morning, I had an electronic message from Susan, all in capital letters. There was no wrestling. In fact, there hadn't been wrestling on for years, so it's really kind of amazing.
So you have a policy, I think, of interviewing people who are members of white supremacist groups and
sure.
who have been involved in crimes, of interviewing them in public places, so they can't.
Well, I've been careful. I actually went to Cherry's house.
Yeah.
I think one time I've interviewed Beck within his house. I guess my rule is I tend not to. Edgar A. Killen wanted me to come visit him at his house at night, so I kind of drew the line there. And so we met over Catfish at a public, you know, a restaurant, obviously, mm-hmm. in Walnut Grove, Mississippi. It was one of those all-you-can-eat $8.95 Catfish places, which I love, too. And, it was good catfish, I'll say that. And but he, you know, he talked, one of the stories, he insisted he didn't have anything to do with it, but then he went on to say, I asked him, well, what should happen to the people who did kill these three boys? And he says, well, I'm not going to say they were wrong. And then he shared a story. I mean, and again, it just kind of shocks you that people would share this kind of stuff, particularly like we're talking about in public. But he told this story about himself. In 1968, right the morning after Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, the FBI agents literally went all over the country, you know, trying to talk to people. They didn't know who was responsible at that point. So a couple of agents showed up at the doorstep of Edgar A. Killen, Mississippi, Union, Mississippi, and wanted to know his whereabouts. He refused to talk to him, would not talk to him, but they left their card. Time goes on. He picks up the card. He calls the agent, wants to know who killed King. The agent's like, why do you want to know? And Killen was like, man, I want to shake his hand. So just to let you know, a lot of these guys, old Klan guys, really haven't changed at all. They hold to the same mentality, justification for violence and things along those lines. So these are not, I think sometimes when you see the video, you think, oh, that poor old grandpa, you know, what are they trying him for? You know, poor old guy, why don't they just leave him alone? But these people, not only are they not sorry for their crimes, but they're happy to have done it. I mean, they feel totally justified in what they did.
Have you had death threats placed against you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's it kind of, I hate to say it kind of goes with the territory, but it does, I think, when you're doing this kind of work. I spent about 6 hours interviewing Byron D. LeBeckwith, and he lived in Signal Mountain, Tennessee, which is right outside of Chattanooga. I always tell people, you know, Signal Mountain's a beautiful place when the sun's going down, but not if you happen to be with Byron D. LeBeckwith. So he insisted on walking me out to the car, and I'm like, that's okay, really. I think I can find my car. I'm not sure I need your help. And he walked me out anyway. So we got out to the car, and he's like, if you write positive things about white Caucasian Christians, God will bless you. If you write negative things about white Caucasian Christians, God will punish you. If God does not punish you directly, several individuals will do it for him.
Oh, gosh. Oh, and so how seriously do you take that? Go ahead, yeah.
Well, his wife had made me a sandwich. and so you can probably guess what I did with the sandwich.
Do you call the police after that?
I didn't call them on that one. I did call the FBI after this white supremacist guy called, and when I was working on Bowers, and told me he had pictures of me and my family and knew where I lived and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and basically threatening harm against us. So I did call the FBI in that case. Come to find out the guy lived in, like, South Carolina. So I thought, well, at least he has to drive a ways, you know. So
take some comfort in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, after doing all this incredible investigative reporting that you've done that reopens civil rights murders, do you have, and after interviewing some of the people behind those murders, mm-hmm. some of the most racist people in America, do you have different impressions of your state or people who might be your neighbors or, you know, of the country?
That's a good question. I think it's very easy to make these things into simplistic, kind of two-dimensional things. For example, I give Beckwith as an example. If you were, you know, from the comments even that I was sharing with you, I mean, you would think, some people might think of Beckwith or seeing him in the movie Ghost of Mississippi, portrayed in Ghost of Mississippi, people would think he's just the, you know, they view him as Satan incarnate, you know. But it's much more complex than that, because Beckwith, for example, when I showed up, he welcomed me like a long-lost cousin, but it was because I had kind of passed the quiz. You know, he won't talk to anybody except a white, Christian, Southern, you know. You have to, like, pass all these questions in order to talk to him. And I knew with my upbringing that he would love all my answers, so I didn't have a problem answering all these personal questions. And sure enough, and so he was very gracious. I mean, he was kind to his wife, you know, kind to his family. Would strike you otherwise as just this kind old grandfather, like I said. And so it's very fascinating to me. And, you know, what is it that turns somebody like that into a racist? And I find that part very fascinating.
Do you have any thoughts about what it is that does turn someone like that?
Yeah, with regard to Beckwith, I do. Beckwith was an orphan by age 12. And, you know, everybody else, there were a few other reporters who actually did get to talk to him. And I think everybody else was trying to do one of those gotcha interviews. And I didn't really have any interest in that. Instead, I really wanted to know what made him a racist. And I think I sort of got an answer. Because he was an orphan, and, you know, we're kind of guessing now, we're kind of playing the psychologist here, but he was an orphan, and what I found from what he told me, he joined basically everything. He joined every organization. He was definitely a follower, not a leader, and in the end, he joined the Klan. And so I think that kind of maybe helps to explain, and if you understand too, I mean, he's someone who was born within those times. I think he thought he was going to get a parade when he killed Medgar Evers. I think that's what he really expected. He thought everybody was going to come pat him on the back. Thank you, D-Lay, for doing this. And, you know, I think that's what he really expected. And, of course, that wasn't the response he got.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Jerry Mitchell. His reporting has led to the reopening of several unsolved murder cases from the civil rights era, which subsequently ended in convictions. Mitchell writes for the Clarion Ledger of Jackson, Mississippi. Next Tuesday, he'll receive the John Chancellor Award for Excellence in Journalism, which is administered by the Columbia University School of Journalism. His most important sources have been white supremacists. Have you met white supremacists who have used the Bible to justify their racism?
Beckwith.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. He's part of, and this, it's a belief, and so therefore it kind of transcends group lines. It goes beyond just groups, certain groups, but it's called Christian identity. And Beckwith was an adherent to that, or was an adherent to that. And he basically believes, this is kind of it in a nutshell, so I'm putting it pretty bluntly, unfortunately, but he believes that Adam and Eve were white people. He believes that all the non-white races were created on the sixth day with the animals, and so therefore, of course, they don't have souls in his eyes. And then he believes that Eve mated with Satan, the serpent, and that's where Jews came from, and that Cain was the first Jew. I know this is horrible, horribly racist stuff, but this is what he and, unfortunately, others believe. This is Christian identity stuff. But they point to scriptures, and I'll give you an example. In the Garden of Eden, it says, there was no man to till the soil, you know, that basically everything grew on its own. So he took me to that verse, because I was asking him where he's getting all this from, and he was pointing me to, you know, various verses. And he said the word man there is, in Hebrew, is Adam or Adam, and he's correct on that. And it literally means blood in the face. That's correct, too. And he said that only the white race could blush or show blood in the face. So this is proof that Adam and Eve were white people. And that's how ridiculous, you know, this kind of stuff is. But that's what, unfortunately, they rely on.
Edgar Ray Killen was 80 when he was convicted of the murders of the civil rights workers Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. And
right.
In that sense, do you feel like this is kind of like the end of the era? It's the very end of the era where people who might have been involved in crimes against civil rights activists, this is like their last moments on earth, and if justice is going to be done while they're alive, this is like the last minute. Yeah,
the window is closing. I've said this for the past several years. The window is closing very quickly on these cases. I mean, the window kind of opened and it's closing very quickly now. Of course, Justice Department is supposedly going to have a cold cases unit to begin looking at these cases. You know, I just wish that if they were going to do that, they'd done that like 10 years ago, because it's going to be very difficult at this point.
How has your life been changed by the stories that you've been writing and the attention you've been getting for them?
Attention-wise, I guess, I wouldn't say anything drastic. I mean, I think mainly it's helped me realize a lot of things. I mean, it made me realize that, you know, here I was as a kid, and these things were taking place around me, and I had no idea. And it just lets you know how, if we're not really in tune with what's going on, we really can be misled. We can be just left in the dark. And I really made me realize that going through this process, and really opened my eyes to a lot of things. I know that one of the most moving things that I ever witnessed was in the Dahmer case, Vernon Dahmer case. After Sam Bowers was convicted, there was a hearing, and Billy Roy Pitts testified. And then as he walked to the back of the courtroom, he ran into the Dahmer family. There was Mrs. Dahmer, Vernon Dahmer's widow, and some other family members. And Billy Roy Pitts asked Mrs. Dahmer to forgive him for what he had done. And she did. And she began to cry. He began to cry. The Damer children who were there began to cry. And I began to cry too. And it just made me realize that that's really what redemption's all about. Trying to make things right, even when they've gone so terribly wrong in the past.
And do you think Billy Roy Pitts was sincere about wanting to be forgiven? Do you think he really cared?
I got the sense that he did. Uh-huh. I got the sense that he did. He and I talked a lot about it after. I am a person of faith and a Christian, and there's a book that Philip Yancey wrote years ago that's called What's So Amazing About Grace. And so we talked a lot about forgiveness. And he told me how he felt like that a big burden had been lifted off of him when she forgave him.
Well, Jerry Mitchell, congratulations on your award.
Well, thank you.
And thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Terry.
Jerry Mitchell writes for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. Next Tuesday, he'll receive the John Chancellor Award for Excellence in Journalism, which is administered by the Columbia University School of Journalism. Coming up, jazz singer Diane Reeves. She sings in the film Good Night and Good Luck.